In every line she wrote, in every gleeful insinuation. When he met her in the parking lot, and she flashed her teeth at him, her bright gaze had said, "I'm going to fix you, Cracker. I'm going to fix you good." The thought gave her joy. He could see it all over her face. He kissed George goodbye on what was left of his brow before he left. 11:26 a.m. Lantern Glass drove at a crawl the whole last quarter of a mile to the office on the western outskirts of town. Smoke billowed across the road in smothering yellow heaps that the headlights could barely penetrate. The wind snatched at her elderly Passat, jolting it this way and that. Once she drove through a whirl of sparks that spattered and died against the hood and the windshield.
"Mom! Mom, look!"
Dorothy called from the back seat, pointing, and Lantern Glass saw a 60-foot-tall pine tree engulfed in a red shroud of flame over on the right side of the road. Nothing else around it was visibly burning, just that one tree.
"Where are the fire trucks?"
Dorothy asked. "Fighting the fire," Lantern Glass said.
"We just passed the fire. Didn't you see the tree?"
"The fire is even worse down the road. That's where they're trying to hold it. They want to keep it from jumping the highway." She didn't add, "and pouring down the hills into St. Vicente." Just before they reached the office, the smoke lifted a little. The Digest was in a squat, unremarkable two-story red brick building, which they shared with a yoga studio and a branch of Merrill Lynch. The parking lot was about half full, and Lantern Glass saw people she knew, other employees, carrying boxes to their cars. She got out and started to walk toward the fire door, and the wind came up behind her and shoved. She saw more sparks floating in the high thermals. Her eyes watered. The late morning stank of char. Lantern Glass took her daughter's hand. They half ran and were half carried by the gusts to the stairwell. They went up the cement stairs three at a time, almost at a run, as she had so often done before. She wasn't going to be able to pack her weights, still tucked in under the stairwell. If the building burned, they'd be melted back to ingots of raw iron. The fire door to the newsroom was propped open with cinder block. It was a modest office space, containing six desks of the cheapest quality, low particle board dividers arranged between them. At the far side of the room was a floor-to-ceiling glass partition, looking into the only private office at the Digest, Tim Chen's. Tim stood in his office door, clutching a cardboard file box with some framed photographs and several coffee cups balanced on top. Shane Wolfe was there, too, sitting at a desk by the fire door, dismantling a PC and neatly setting the components into a cardboard box. Several other computers had already been removed. An intern, a wispy, nervous 19-year-old girl named Julia, was pulling steel drawers from the file cabinet that occupied most of one wall and stacking them on a dolly. A short, solidly built sports rider named Don Quigley used bungee cable to strap them in place. The atmosphere was one of quiet, industrious urgency. "Lantern Glass," Tim said and nodded toward her desk, which was the one closest to his office.
"I'm on it. I can pack everything I've got in 10 minutes.
"Don't pack. Write."
Lantern Glass said, "You aren't serious."
"I think we both know I'm famously humor deficient. I put an alert on the website about the bullet. The TV news is already running with it. I want the full story uploaded to the server by noon."
"Then you can pack," he said as he hurried past her carrying his box.
"My car is unlocked," Lantern Glass said. "Bring up my laptop. It's in the back seat." He jerked his head in a gesture that seemed to indicate assent, and hauled his file box out and down the stairs. She slowed near Shane Wolfe.
"I'm going to miss this place if it burns down. Some of the most mediocre hours of my life were spent in this very room. You think you'll miss anything about coming here?"
"Watching you run up and down the stairs," he said. "Nothing mediocre about that."
"Ew," Dorothy said. "Mama, he's hitting on you."
"Who says?" Shane asked her. "Maybe I'm a fitness nut. Maybe I just admire someone who shows real dedication to staying in shape.
Dorothy narrowed one eye to a squint and said, "You hitting on her?"
"Pfft," Shane said. "Don't go ragging on me now. I'm not the one walking around with my head stuck up a chicken's butt."
Dorothy touched her chicken hat and giggled, and Lantern Glass tugged her hand and led her onto her desk. A stack of flattened cardboard boxes leaned against the full-wall window looking into Tim Shen's office. Lantern Glass assembled one, and she and Dorothy began to empty out her desk. The box was half full when Tim returned with her laptop bag. She fired up her aging MacBook and opened a new document while Dorothy continued to pack the box. Lantern Glass began to write, starting with her headline, "Crime Scene Discovery Raises Questions." Shit, that was terrible. Too general, too vague. She deleted it. Tried another. Number one with a bullet. Crime Scene Fuck no, that was even worse. It was hard to think. She had a sense of the world coming apart around her, buckling and splitting at the seams. In his office, Tim Chen was throwing piles of folders into a box. Shane Wolfe was on the other side of the room with part of the carpet torn back. He yanked a long Ethernet cable out from under it, gathering it in loops. A file cabinet with all its drawers hanging open overbalanced and fell with a crash. The wispy intern screamed. The sports writer laughed. At Lantern Glass's back, she heard the wind whap against the windows, and suddenly Dorothy jumped to her feet, staring outside with enormous eyes.
"Whoa, Mom, it's really blowing," she said.
Lantern Glass rotated in her office chair for a look. For a moment they all stopped what they were doing and stood still to stare through the windows. Fog roiled and foamed on the other side of the glass, all but obscuring the parking lot below. The wind roared, rushing the cloud along, the smoke a poisonous shade of yellow. Sparks whirled. For the first time, Aisha Lantern Glass wondered if it had been a good idea to bring her daughter along with her to the office, if there was a chance of the flames overwhelming the fire department and reaching the building while they were still in it. But no, that was ridiculous. They didn't even have to be out of the facility until tomorrow morning. The Park Service would not have allowed them so much time to evacuate if there was any real danger. Besides, people were still arriving to help with the move. Down in the lot, she dimly saw a bright red Prius turning in off the highway. Then the smoke thickened, and she lost sight of it.
"Come on," Lantern Glass said. "Finish up, honey. I just need to do this, and we can go."
She began to type again. New title. "A Single Bullet Changes Everything." There. That had plenty of zing. Anyone who read that would just have to go on to the next line, whatever the next line was going to be. Lantern Glass would find her way to it in a moment. She narrowed her eyes, squinting at the screen, like a shooter taking aim.
"What the fuck?"
said the sports writer in a strangely shrill voice. He was standing in the doorway leading to the stairwell, ready to slow walk the dolly down the steps. Lantern Glass heard him, but did not look over, was deep in her story space, forming the next sentence in her mind. She did not look until the AR-15 went off with one flat, deafening crack, and then another, and then a third. She glanced around in time to see the sports writer's head snap back, blood scattering in a fine spray across the particle board ceiling above and behind him. He fell backward, bringing the iron dolly down on top of him, boxes sliding out from under the bungee cables holding them in place, and crashing to the floor. Killaway stepped in and over the body, the bushmaster just above the level of his hip, the strap thrown over his shoulder. Big man, in a dove-colored polo already stained with blood. Shane Wolfe, in the far corner of the room, rose to his full height, holding several loops of Ethernet cable. He lifted his free hand, palm out.
"Hey, whatever you want," he said,
and Kellaway shot him in the stomach and the chest, driving him back into the window behind him. Shane's shoulders hit the glass hard enough to put a pair of spiderweb cracks in it.
Lantern Glass shoved her chair back with her rear and dropped to one knee. Dorothy had stood up to see what was happening, but Lantern Glass grabbed her wrist and pulled hard, and the girl dropped to her knees. Lantern Glass put her arms around her daughter and dragged her in under the desk. The Bushmaster went off with more of those flat, hard reports. That would be the sound of Kellaway killing Julia, the intern. From her position in the footwell under her desk, Lantern Glass could see the windows overlooking the parking lot and a bit of Tim Chen's private office through the wide panel of glass that served as one wall. Tim stood behind his desk, staring out into the office pool with bewildered eyes. Beyond the windows, the smoke boiled and rushed, driven by the wind. Another spinning wheel of sparks blew past. Dorothy shuddered, and Lantern Glass held her daughter's head to her breast and pressed her mouth to her daughter's hair. She breathed in the deep smell of her child's scalp, of Dorothy's coconut creme shampoo. The child's wiry arms were around her mother's waist, and Lantern Glass thought, "Don't let him have seen us. Please, God, don't let him have seen us. Please, God, let this child live." Tim Chen disappeared from Lantern Glass's view, moving toward the door of his office. He had picked up a marble bookend, a block of pink and white stone, the only thing he could find to fight with. Lantern Glass heard him shout, an inarticulate cry of horror and rage, and the Bushmaster went off again, chonk, 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 not 8 feet away, just the other side of her desk. Tim Chen fell so hard the floor shook. Her ears rang strangely. She had never held her daughter so tightly, could not have squeezed her any harder without breaking something. Lantern Glass took the tiniest sip of air, was afraid that if she inhaled too deeply, Kellaway would hear. But then, maybe he would not be able to hear anything after firing so many shots. Maybe after all that gunfire, he would be deaf to the small sounds of a shaking girl and a quietly gasping mother. The wind roared, rising and rising in volume. Lantern Glass stared out through the windows into the smoke, and with a kind of horrified wonder saw a twisting rope of flame, 300 feet tall, out in the murk, an incendiary top whirling down the middle of the highway, a slender tornado of fire, reaching up into the suffocating white sky and disappearing. If it turned toward the building, perhaps it would strike and tear apart the bricks and carry her daughter, Dorothy, away to some golden, burning, terrible, yet wonderful Oz. Maybe it would carry them both away. At the sight of it, Aisha Lantern Glass's chest filled with an awe that was like breath, swelling her lungs, swelling her heart. The beauty of the world and the horror of the world were twined together like wind and flame. The smoke rose, filthy and dark, and pressed against the glass, and then subsided, and suddenly that blazing, twisting stairwell into the clouds was gone. One combat boot appeared, coming down in front of their hiding place in the footwell beneath the desk. Dorothy's eyes were squeezed shut. She didn't see. Lantern Glass stared out over her daughter's head, holding her breath. The other boot appeared. He was standing right in front of the desk. Slowly, slowly, Kellaway bent down to look in at them, holding the butt of the Bushmaster under his right armpit. He stared upon Lantern Glass and her little girl with something very like serenity in his pale blue, almost white eyes. "Just think, if you had a gun," he said to her, "this story might have a different ending."
Aloft. 1. He hated it in the back of the little plane, squished in with the others. He hated the reek of gasoline and moldy canvas and his own rancid farts, and by the time they reached 6,000 feet, Aubrey Griffin decided he couldn't go. "I'm so sorry to do this, man," Aubrey began, calling over his shoulder to the guy he thought of as Axe. His jumpmaster's name had flown out of his head as soon as the dude introduced himself. By then, Aubrey was having trouble hanging on to even the most basic information. In the half hour before they had boarded the single-engine Cessna, Aubrey's panic was making a roar of static that filled his head. People looked him right in the face and said things, shouted them, really, everyone souped up on adrenaline. But all he heard was unintelligible noise. He could grasp the occasional obscenity, nothing more. So Aubrey began to think of him as Axe, short for Axe Body Spray, because the guy looked like he'd walked off the set of a commercial featuring hot rods, explosions, and models having pillow fights in their underwear. The Jumpmaster was fit and lanky, with golden red hair cut short and feathered back, and he possessed a coked-up energy that amplified rather than subdued Aubrey's terror. How absurd was it to have considered putting his life in the hands of someone he didn't even know by name? "What'd you say?" Axe yelled. It didn't seem like it should be so hard to make himself heard, especially to a guy who was strapped to his ass. They were harnessed together. Aubrey sat in Axe's lap like a child getting cozy with a shopping mall Santa. "I can't do this. I hope like hell I could. I really thought..." Axe shook his head. "That's normal. Everyone gets that." He was going to make him plead. Aubrey didn't want to plead, not in front of Harriet. To his dismay, he uncorked another string of greasy farts. They were inaudible over the drone of the engine, but they burned and stank. Axe had to be tasting every one of them. It was awful to be pathetic in front of Harriet Cornell. It didn't matter that he and Harriet were never going to date, never be in love, never lie nude beneath cool sheets in St. Bart's with the French windows open and the sound of the waves crashing on the reefs in the distance. He still had his daydreams to protect. It dismayed Aubrey to think this was the last memory of him that Harriet would take with her to Africa. Harriet and Aubrey were both on their first jumps, or maybe it was more accurate to say Harriet was on her first jump. Aubrey had come to see in the last few moments that he was not. They were going tandem, which meant each of them was buckled to a Jumpmaster, men who did this every day. Brad and Ronnie Morris were in the plane as well. This was old hat for them, though, both boys experienced skydivers. June Morris was dead, and they were all jumping in her memory. Her brothers, Brad and Ronnie, Harriet, who had been her best friend, and Aubrey himself. June had been dead 6 weeks, wiped out at 23 by cancer. That was some odds-defying shit right there, Aubrey thought. It seemed to Aubrey you were about as likely to become a rock star as you were to die that young of something like lymphoma. "There's nothing normal about it," Aubrey shouted now. "I have a clinical diagnosis as a quivering pussy. Seriously, if you make me jump, I'm going to fill my pants with hot, creamy shit, man." At that moment, the sound dropped in the hollow, roaring stainless steel capsule of the light aircraft, and his voice carried from one end of the plane to the other. Aubrey was aware of Brad and Ronnie turning to look at him. They both had GoPro cameras screwed to their helmets. Presumably, all this would be on YouTube later. "The first rule of skydiving, don't take a shit on the Jumpmaster," Axe said. The mindless thunder of the engine rose again. Brad and Ronnie looked away. Aubrey didn't want to glance over at Harriet, but couldn't help himself. She wasn't staring at him, although he thought she had only just turned her face away. She clutched a small purple stuffed horse with a silver horn protruding from its brow and twee iridescent wings behind its forelegs, the Junicorn. Harriet and the Junicorn were turned to face the door, a big, loose, rattling hatch made out of clear plastic. Every time the plane tilted to the left, Aubrey was consumed by the sickening certainty that the door would flap open and he'd slide right out while Axe Body Spray hacked a maniacal, coked-up laugh. It seemed like nothing was holding it shut. Fucking nothing. The way Harriet was pointedly not looking at him was almost as unpleasant as if she'd been staring at him with a mixture of pity and disappointment. Aubrey didn't need Axe to give him permission to stay in the plane. His opinion didn't matter. What Aubrey wanted was for Harriet to tell him it was all right. No, what he wanted was to go out the side of the plane with her, ahead of her. But to do that, he would have had to be someone else. Maybe that was what he hated most. Not his queasy stomach, not his sick farts. Not the collapse of his nerve. Maybe what he despised most was being found out. Was anything in all the world more heartrending than being found out by someone you wanted to love you? He leaned forward and thunked his helmet against hers to get her attention. She turned her face toward him, and he saw for the first time that she was pale and drawn, lips pressed so tightly together that all the color had gone out of them. It came to him with something like relief that she was terrified, too. He grasped at an idea with an almost frantic hope. Maybe she would stay in the plane with him. If they were cowards together, the situation would no longer be shameful and tragic. It would be the most hilarious thing ever. He had meant to tell her he was backing out, but now, seized by this new notion, he shouted, "How you doing?" Prepared to comfort her. Looking forward to it, in fact. "I'm this close to throwing up." "Me too," he cried, perhaps with a dash too much enthusiasm. "I'm shivering like a leaf. Jesus, I'm so glad I'm not the only one." "I don't want to be here," she said, her helmet resting against his, their noses almost touching. Her eyes, the cool greenish-brown of a frozen marsh, were wide with undisguised anxiety. "Fuck," he said. "Me neither. Me neither." He was close to laughter, close to taking her hand. She shifted her gaze back to that door of clear rattling plastic. "I don't want to sit one more second in this plane. I just want to be out there doing it. It's like waiting in line for a roller coaster. The wait just about kills you. You can't stop building it up in your mind. But then, when you're on the ride, you're like, why was I so scared? I want to do this again." A weak, small, oily fart of disappointment slipped free. The enthusiasm, the swell of sweet courage he heard in her voice, filled him with Seattle grunge levels of despair. Harriet's eyes widened. She pointed out the clattering door and shouted with an almost childlike excitement, "Hey! Hey, guys! Spaceship!" "What's that?" cried the big lumber sexual, spooning her from behind. Harriet was strapped to a chunky guy with the kind of bushy beard that suggested a closet full of flannel shirts and a second job serving fair trade espresso in an upscale coffee house. When it was time to pair up with the Jumpmaster, Aubrey had acted quickly to claim Axe body spray. He didn't want Harriet leaping out a plane with the dude, her ass nestled against the guy's probable erection all the way down. The Wookiee had paired with Harriet. Unfortunately, and predictably, she and the furry fat guy had been falling around laughing from their first moments together. By lunch, the two of them were duetting to an a cappella version of Total Eclipse of the Heart, her chubby Jumpmaster singing the male parts in a warm, low, surprisingly soulful voice. Aubrey loathed him. It was Aubrey's role to be soulful and to surprise Harriet with laughter. He loathed all clever, decent fat men who cozied their way into Harriet's spontaneous hugs. "There," Harriet cried. "There, there! Aubrey, you see it?"
"See what?" yelled her Wookiee, even though she wasn't talking to him.
"That cloud. Look at that weird cloud. It looks just like a UFO." Aubrey didn't want to look. He didn't want to go anywhere near that door, but he couldn't help himself. Axe was edging closer to see what she was pointing at and taking Aubrey along for the ride. Harriet pointed at a cloud shaped just like a flying saucer from a 1950s alien invasion flick. It was wide and circular, and at the center it was mounted up in a cottony dome.
"Kind of big for a UFO," shouted Chewbacca-ish.
He was right. That cloud had to be almost a mile across.
"It's the mothership," Harriet cried with glee. "I saw one that looked like a donut once," Axe said. "Like God blew a smoke ring. Had a big hole in the middle. We're much closer to the supernatural up here. Everything gets very surreal when you're falling from 12,000 feet. Reality gets as flimsy as parachute silk, and your mind opens to new possibilities." "Oh, fuck you and your flimsy parachute silk reality." That was Aubrey's view. Fuck Axe and his promise that the experience would open Harriet to new possibilities, like maybe a post-jump three-way with Axe and Harriet's furry Jumpmaster. Harriet shook her head with satisfaction. "June would have loved that cloud. She believed they walk among us, the Greys, the visitors." Fat and Furry said, "We'll get a closer look pretty soon. We're almost at jump altitude." Aubrey felt a poke of fresh alarm, like the stick of a needle. But for an instant anyway, the jump was only the second thing on his mind. He leaned forward, hardly aware he was doing it, surprising Axe, who had to lean forward with him. The harness joining them together creaked. Aubrey watched the cloud for half a minute as they climbed and began to circle toward it. They would pass right above it in a moment or two. Then he looked past Harriet at the guy with the beard. "Yeah," he said. "Yeah, man, she's right. That cloud is fucked up. Look again."
Harriet's Jumpmaster said,
"It's a fine specimen of a cumulonimbus. Very cool."
"No, it's not. It's not cool. It's weird." The Wookiee gave him a glance of appraisal that seemed to mingle boredom with contempt. Aubrey shook his head, annoyed that the guy didn't get it, and pointed again. "It's going that way," Aubrey said, jabbing a finger to the north.
"So what?" Brad Morris called out.
For the second time in the last few minutes, everyone was looking at Aubrey. "All the other clouds are going in the opposite direction," Aubrey yelled, pointing south.
"It's going the wrong way."
2. The cloud held their attention for one shared moment of respectful silence before the chubby jumpmaster explained,
"It's called an airbox. It's a pattern of circular flow. The air pushes in one direction at one altitude, then folds back and shoves everything in the exact opposite direction at a different altitude. When you go up in a hot air balloon, a current like that means you can float away from your point of departure, then drop a couple thousand feet and float back to the exact same place you took off."
The chubby jumpmaster did hot air balloon rides, too, and had offered to take Harriet up sometime for free. An evil suggestion, as far as Aubrey was concerned, tantamount to inviting her to a sex club for a lazy night of cocaine and hand jobs. Aubrey supposed most men who went into skydiving and ballooning and other forms of high-altitude devilry did it for the pussy. There were all those opportunities to buckle girls into safety harnesses, to cop a feel when comforting them in a moment of high anxiety, to win their admiration with cheery shows of fearlessness. Of course, to be fair, Aubrey himself wouldn't have been in the plane if not to impress Harriet.
"Oh," Harriet said, shrugging with mock disappointment. "Too bad. I thought we were about to make contact."
Axe held up two fingers, Churchill declaring victory on VE Day.
2 minutes.
Harriet bopped her helmet against Aubrey's and met his gaze.
"Yes?"
Aubrey tried to smile, but it felt more like a grimace.
"No,"
he said, "I can't."
"You can, though," Axe shouted, finally deciding not to pretend he couldn't hear. "This whole experience is about the power of can."
Aubrey ignored him. Axe body spray didn't matter. The only thing that concerned him was how Harriet took it.
"I really wanted to," he told her.
Harriet nodded and took his hand.
"I have to. I promised June."
Of course, he had promised June, too. When Harriet said she would jump, Aubrey had sworn he'd be screaming all the way down right beside her. At the time, June was dying, and it had seemed like the right thing to do.
"I feel like shit," Aubrey began.
"Don't worry," Harriet yelled. "I think it's rad you came this far. I doubled up on my anti-anxiety meds and everything." He wished he could stop explaining himself.
1 minute, Axe yelled.
"It's all right, Aubrey," Harriet said, smiling impishly. "Hey, I better get myself ready, right?"
"Right," he agreed, nodding feverishly. "I'm set to go," Ronnie Morris shouted. "I could use the fresh air."
Brad Morris laughed, and they slapped each other 5. It stung Aubrey that they could make a joke out of the cowardly farts stinking up the compartment. Bad enough that he was pitifully scared, but even worse to be betrayed by his body, and then ridiculed for it. Aubrey looked at Harriet, but her gaze was intent on the clear plastic door now. He had been dismissed from her thoughts. That felt worse than he had imagined it would. He had expected her to be disappointed in him, but she wasn't disappointed, just indifferent. He'd made himself believe he had to do this, had to be here for June, for Harriet. But in fact, his presence one way or another was of no matter. And now that he was sure he wasn't going, he felt listless and deflated. Harriet was holding up the Junicorn and whispering to it, pointing it out at the vast UFO-shaped cloud, just as the Cessna banked toward it. Axe fiddled with the camera on his own helmet.
"Hey, listen, Audrey man."
It was a small bitter pleasure that the jumpmaster didn't know his name either.
"If you've made up your mind, it's your right to back out, but you should know it costs the same whether you go or not. I can't even refund you the cost of your DVD.
"I'm sorry I ruined everyone's good time," Aubrey announced, but the really miserable thing was that he hadn't ruined anything for any of them. No one was even listening. The plane tilted ever more steeply into its turn.
"We're going to circle back over the landing strip," Axe began,
which was when everything shut off. The propeller on the nose of the little Cessna whined and clattered and stopped turning very abruptly. Wind whooshed under the wings, the soft bellow filling the sudden silence. The running lights inside the jump compartment blinked out. The vast, whistling silence amazed Aubrey more than it frightened him.
"What happened?" Harriet asked. "Lenny?" Axe shouted toward the front of the plane. What the hell, man? We just stall out?
The pilot, a curly-haired guy in a puffy headset, flipped a toggle switch, pulled a long steel stick out of the dash, and poked a button. The Cessna floated, a sheet of newspaper hovering above a subway grate. Lenny, the pilot, looked over his shoulder at them and shrugged. He wore a white T-shirt with the Kool-Aid mascot on it, that inanely smiling pitcher of red juice. He yanked his headset down around his neck.
I don't know, Lenny yelled. He didn't sound worried, more annoyed. Maybe, but I also got no electric. Everything just died. It's like a connection is loose in the battery.
The Cessna quivered, wings tilting minutely, this way and that.
No big deal to me, Brad said. I was going to step out right around here anyway.
Yeah,
Ronnie said. I was thinking I'd like to stretch my legs. Go on, Lenny called. Jump. After everyone is out, I'll dive and pop it. If that doesn't work, I'll have to glide her in. Hope I hit the runway. Gonna be bumpy if I don't.
Oh, come on, Aubrey shouted. Come on, this is bullshit. I don't believe a word. Brad scooted to the door and rotated the stainless steel latches that held it shut, one after the other. He pushed it up and out of the way. The opening was roughly as wide as a soccer net. He put a foot onto the piping that ran under the door.
Audrey, my friend, Axe said gently.
No, Aubrey shouted. This isn't funny. Make him start the plane. You can't coerce someone to jump this way.
See you on the dirt, Brad said.
He clung to the side of the plane, facing in toward them, one hand holding the rail above. With his free hand, he snapped off a jaunty salute. Asshole, stepped from the plane and was snatched away by the sky.
Audrey, breathe, Axe said. No one is running a game on you. There is a problem with the aircraft.
He spoke very slowly and enunciated each word with care.
We would never shut a plane off to scare you into jumping. Honestly, a lot of people back out last minute. I don't care. I get paid the same either way.
Why would the plane just stop working?
I don't know, but believe me, we don't want to be in it when he tries to pop the engine.
Why not?
Because he's going to point it at the ground.
Ron Morris scooted to the edge of the open door, preparing to follow his brother. He sat for a moment, feet on the bar that ran along the outside of the plane, elbows resting on his knees, enjoying the view. The blast of the wind made his skin ripple, distorted the loose flesh of his chubby face. Gradually, almost like a man nodding off, he tipped forward, then dropped head first, and was gone.
"Hurry up back there!" shouted Lenny from the single seat at the controls.
Harriet had been sitting between her jumpmaster's legs, looking from Aubrey to Axe to the pilot with a fearful fascination. She squeezed the Junicorn to her chest, as if worried someone might be about to try to snatch it away from her. The Junicorn was a stand-in for June herself, and Harriet was under orders to look after it and take it with her while she did all the things June was never going to get to do. See pyramids, surf in Africa, skydive. Aubrey had the ridiculous sense of being stared at by girl and stuffed animal alike.
Aubrey, Harriet said, I think we ought to go, right now, both of us.
She looked past Aubrey to Axe.
Can we go together, like hold hands?
Axe shook his head.
We'll be 3 seconds behind you.
Please, if we could just hold hands, my friend is scared, but I know he can do this if we go together, she said,
and Aubrey loved her so much he felt like crying. He wanted to tell her right now that he loved her, but that was even more beyond him than stepping out over a 12,000-foot drop.
It's not a good idea in a first jump. Our drogue chutes could tangle. Harriet, please go. We'll follow.
The chubby jumpmaster began to scoot across the steel floor on his butt, shifting Harriet away and closer to the door.
Audrey, Axe said. His voice was soothing and calm and reasonable. If we do not go, you are risking my life as well as your own. I want to jump while we can. I'd prefer your consent.
Oh, God.
Close your eyes.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. This is fucked.
Harriet and her jumpmaster had shifted all the way over to the open hatch. Harriet's legs were hanging out. She cast a final pleading look at Aubrey over her shoulder. Then she grasped her jumpmaster's hand, and they were gone.
You'll have solid ground under your feet before you know it, Axe said.
Aubrey shut his eyes. He nodded okay.
I'm sorry, I'm so chicken shit, Aubrey said.
Axe humped them across the bare steel, sliding them toward the opening in modest increments. Aubrey thought, randomly, that he was glad Harriet wasn't sitting in Axe's lap,
feeling him pump his hips against her ass this way. "Have you ever jumped with anyone worse than me?" Aubrey asked. "Not really," Axe said, and pushed them out the side of the plane. It was more than 10,000 feet to the ground, 1 minute of free fall and perhaps 4 minutes of slow, gliding hang time in the parachute. But Aubrey Griffin and his jumpmaster dropped just under 4 stories before they struck the edge of the UFO-shaped cloud that wasn't really a cloud at all, and stopped falling.
3. Fear thickens time, turns it slow and viscous. 1 second of deeply felt terror lasts longer than 10 regular seconds. Aubrey fell for only a moment, but it was an instant that lasted longer than the whole long circling climb into the sky on board the Cessna. As they went through the door, Aubrey tried to turn to stay in the plane just as Axe was pulling them out. He plunged backward, looking up at the aircraft with the jumpmaster beneath him. Aubrey dropped with a great tingling thrill of emotion that ran from balls to throat, a single thought beating in his mind as he fell.
Still alive. Still alive. Still alive. Still...
And then they hit. What they struck didn't feel at all like Earth, but much closer to raw bread dough. It was thick and rubbery and cold, and if they had dropped only 10 or even 15 feet into it, it might have been a soft, springy landing. In fact, though, they had fallen 39 feet, and Axe absorbed the full brunt of the impact. The fragile hoops of his pelvis snapped in 3 places. The upper part of his right femur broke with a pop. Aubrey's helmet snapped back into Axe's face and smashed his nose, which shattered with a glassy crack. Aubrey himself was not entirely unhurt. Axe kneed him in the hip hard enough to make a gruesome bruise. He also banged his funny bone so sharply he lost all the sensation in his right hand. Dry, cold smoke erupted around them in a great puff. It had a sharp odor like pencil shavings, like the wheels of a train, like lightning.
"Hey," Aubrey said in a thin, shaking voice. "Hey, what happened?"
Axe cried.
Are you all right?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, cocksucker.
All that high, singing emotion had been slammed out of Aubrey on impact. All the thought had been slammed out of him, too. He waved his arms and legs in the helpless, struggling motion of a beetle turned over on its back. He stared up into the clear blue. He could still see the plane, the size of a toy, above them, but tilting away to the east. It was funny how far away it was already. Axe sobbed. The sound was so unexpected, so dreadful, it shocked Aubrey out of his stunned, blank, amazed state. He made a fist with his right hand, trying to work the feeling back into it.
"Can you unbuckle me?" he asked.
"I don't know," Axe said. "Oh, man, I think I'm really fucked up."
"What did we hit?" Aubrey asked.
It looked like a cloud, which didn't make any sense. "What are we on?" Axe panted in a horrible, frantic sort of way. Aubrey thought he was working up to another sob.
"You have to unclip me," Aubrey said.
Axe groped up and down Aubrey's sides. 1 carabiner snapped loose, then another, then a third, and finally the fourth, and Aubrey rolled off him, wrestled his way up into a sitting position, and looked around. He sat on the cloud, an island of churned white cream, adrift in a vastness of serene blue. They were at one tip of a mass, almost a mile long, with a great central bulge in the shape of a dome. It reminded Aubrey of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. A sense of nausea tickled the inside of his throat. His head swam. He pressed his tingling right hand into the cloud. At first he was pushing his palm down into cool drifting vapor, but as he sank his weight into it, the fog stiffened into a solid, with the consistency of cream cheese or maybe mashed potatoes or, really, Play-Doh. When Aubrey lifted his hand, the cloud melted back into mist.
"Fuck," he said.
For the moment, it was the most sophisticated response he could manage.
"Oh, dude. Oh, God, something is really broken inside me."
Aubrey turned a stunned stare upon the other man, who was writhing and twisting weakly in the unsettled smoke. His heels kicked at the mist, drawing furrows in that weird, semi-solid cream. Axe's sporty goggles, the lenses where the coppery red of a Cape Cod sunset, were smashed. He probably couldn't see, was feeling around blindly with one hand.
The GoPro camera mounted on his helmet gazed blankly and stupidly at Aubrey.
"Did I pull the chute?" Axe asked. "I musta, huh, if we're on the ground. What happened? Did I bang my head on the side of the door going out the plane?"
His voice was strained and feeble with pain. He didn't know where they were. He didn't understand what had happened to them. Aubrey didn't understand what had happened either. It was hard to think. Too much had occurred too quickly, and none of it made sense or seemed real. Axe had not opened their chute, although the drogue chute had deployed automatically. This was a very small secondary chute, a little bucket of red and yellow silk, just big enough to wrap a Thanksgiving turkey. The wind pulled it out and straight back, and now it fluttered kite-like over the edge of the cloud, swerving this way and that. Aubrey wasn't sure what a drogue chute did. Axe had tried to explain, but at the time Aubrey had been too nervous to retain any information. It came to Aubrey that Axe wasn't writhing and twisting after all. He wasn't kicking his feet either. He was lying perfectly still, one arm curled over his torso, the other hand clapped to his hip. His heels were making shallow indentations in the milky paste of the cloud because the drogue chute was slowly, but steadily, hauling him away.
"Hey," Aubrey said. "Hey, man, watch out."
He grabbed the harness around Axe's chest and tugged, and Axe shrieked in pain, a sound so piercing that Aubrey immediately recoiled and let go.
"My chest!" Axe screamed. "My fucking chest! What are you doing?"
"I just want to pull you back from the edge," Aubrey said. He reached for the harness again, and Axe elbowed his hand aside.
"You don't move someone who's been in an accident, you neurotic asshole!" Axe cried. "Don't you know anything?"
"I'm sorry." Axe panted for breath. His cheeks were smeared with tears.
"Edge of what?" Axe asked at last, in a miserable, almost childish voice.
At that moment, the breeze rose, churning the cloud milk around them. The drogue chute swelled, lifted, and suddenly snapped straight back, jerking upward into the bright blue sky. The wind yanked all the parachute cords taut and half-lifted Axe into a sitting position. The jumpmaster screamed again. His boots dragged through the rubbery, puffy cloud stuff, making trenches 6 inches deep. Aubrey thought again of uncooked bread, of someone sinking fingers into raw, elastic dough. Aubrey grabbed for one of those trailing boots, caught it with his still-numb right hand. But there was no feeling in his fingers, and he held it for only a moment before it was yanked right out of his grasp.
"Edge of what?" Axe screamed as he was carried away.
The wind sucked the drogue chute up and back and took him off the edge of the cloud with a sudden whisking motion, like a maid yanking a sheet off a hotel room bed. Axe yelped, grabbed the parachute cords rising around him. He was pulled up into the sky about 6 or 7 feet. Then the wind flagged, and he promptly dropped, past the cloud and out of sight.
4. The wind sang, a shrill, jeering tone barely audible. Aubrey stared at the place where Axe had been, as if he might reappear. After a time, he discovered he was trembling helplessly, although he had left his panic behind on the airplane. What he felt now was bigger than fight or flight. It was shock, perhaps. Or maybe it was just the cold. In the world below, it was the third day of August, an afternoon of dry, wilting heat. Pollen-coated cars in a layer of mustard-colored grime. Bumblebees droned their sleepy trance song in the dry-baked grass. Up here, though, it was a cool morning in early October, as crisp and chilly and sweet as a bite of a ripe apple. He thought, this isn't happening. He thought, I was so scared something snapped in my mind. He thought, I struck my head on the side of the plane, and this is my last giddy fantasy as I die of skull fracture. Aubrey riffled through these possibilities like a man dealing cards, but only in a remote, half-aware sort of way, barely registering them. There was no arguing with the brisk chill in the air or with the whistle of the breeze, which was producing a sharp, clear E note. For a long time, he remained on all fours, peering off the trailing edge of the cloud, wondering if he could move. He was not sure he dared. He felt that if he moved, gravity would notice him and drop him through the cloud. He patted the mist ahead of him, stroked it like a cat. It firmed up into a lumpy, pliant mass at the first touch. Aubrey crawled, his thighs quaking. It was very like moving across a surface of soft clay. When he'd gone a yard or so, he looked back.
The path he was making across the cloud melted after he'd started on his way, turning back to slow, curdling fog. When he was 5 feet from the ragged, trailing southern edge of the cloud, he sank to his belly and lay flat. He squirmed a bit farther on his stomach, his pulse whamming so hard that the day brightened and darkened with each beat of his heart. Aubrey had always been scared of heights. It was a good question why a man with a dread of heights, a man who avoided flying whenever he could, would agree to jump from an airplane. The answer, of course, was maddeningly simple. Harriet. The cloud tapered off at the edge, tapered off but did not give way. The very end of the cloud was only an inch thick, but the firmest, hardest stuff yet, as hard as concrete, with no sense of give at all. Aubrey peeked over the edge. Ohio lay beneath him, an almost perfectly flat expanse of variegated squares and shades of emerald, wheat, richest brown, palest amber. Those would be the famous waves of grain mentioned with such admiration in America the Beautiful. Ruler straight ribbons of blacktop bisected the fields below. A red pickup slid along one of those black threads like a bright steel bead on an abacus. He saw to the south and west the runway of baked red dirt, behind the hangar that housed Cloud 9 skydiving adventures. And there was the Cessna just touching down. Either Lenny had gotten the plane going again or he'd done a fine job of gliding it in. A moment later, Aubrey saw a parachute, a vast, straining tent of gleaming white silk. He watched it sink to the ground and settle in a field that had been planted with something, green rows separated by lines of dark earth. The chute crumpled in on itself. Axe was on the ground then. He was on the ground, and he had been aware enough to pull the ripcord. Axe was down, and soon help would reach him, and he would tell them something. Aubrey could not quite imagine what. I'd left my client on a cloud? Below, the parachute rustled across the field, expanding and shrinking like a lung. When Axe told them what had happened, they were going to figure him for hysterical. A bloodied, badly injured man who raved that he'd landed on a cloud was going to be met with worry and words of comfort, not belief. They were going to reach for the explanation that made the most sense. They were going to assume that Aubrey had come unclipped in some kind of freak accident, possibly after striking the side of the plane. That would explain Axe's injuries as well, and fallen to his death. Even to Aubrey, this seemed a more plausible story than what had really happened, and Aubrey was actually on the cloud, looking down. It was a dreadful idea, but there was also something wrong with it. He tried to see it. Spotting the flaw was as tricksy as trying to find a mosquito that whined in one ear but disappeared when you spun around looking for it. He almost had to stop searching for it, stop thinking altogether. Had to let his eyes go unfocused. A dry, throbbing pain was building in his sinuses, behind his temples. He reviewed his last glimpse of Axe body spray in the instant before the drogue chute yanked him off into the emptiness. And then he saw it. His mind's eye focused in on the stupid, glaring lens of the GoPro mounted atop the Jumpmaster's helmet. The whole thing was on video. No one needed to take Axe's word for what had happened. All they had to do was watch the recording. Then they'd know. Then they'd come for him. 5. Sometime later, he rose to his knees and looked around. The great wheel of cloud still held the pie plate shape of a UFO, with that great dome rising in the exact center, its dominant feature. The rest was far from smooth. The surface bubbled up, ruffled into dunes and hillocks. Aubrey searched the blue sky until he felt dizzy and had to lower his gaze. When his head stopped swimming, he realized he was still on the very edge. A bad place to be. He slid inward on his butt, putting distance between himself and the precipice. At last he decided he was going to have to risk standing up. He pushed himself to his feet, legs still trembling. Aubrey Griffin stood alone on his island of cloud. It came to him slowly that the harness was uncomfortable. The straps made a tight, painful V at his crotch, squeezing his balls. Another strap was tight across his chest, making it hard to breathe. Or was that the skimpy air? He unbuckled the harness and stepped out of it. He was going to drop it into the cloud when he saw the coat rack. It was to his left on the edge of his vision, an old-fashioned coat rack with 8 curved hooks made out of sculpted cloud. He eyed it carefully, feeling dry of throat,
aware his heart was beating much, much too fast. "The fuck is that?" he asked no one in particular. Of course, it was perfectly obvious what it was. Anyone with eyes could see what it was. He told himself it wasn't really a coat rack, that it was just a deformity in the cloud. He circled to inspect it from every angle. It looked like a coat rack no matter where he stood. A coat rack of cloud stuff, but a coat rack nonetheless. Experimentally, he hung the olive-colored harness from one of the hooks. It should have dropped, scattering veils of fog. Instead, it dangled from the hook, rocking in the breeze. Aubrey said, "Ha!" It was not a laugh, but the actual word, a sound of surprise, not hilarity. There was no reason to be surprised, really. The cloud was holding him up, and he weighed 175 pounds. What was a canvas harness that couldn't be all of 2 pounds? He unbuckled his helmet and stuck it on another hook. The ache that had begun in his sinuses was now a skewer of pain that shot from his left temple to the right. That was the skull fracture, he thought, the one he'd picked up when he smashed his head on the side of the plane. That's all any of it was, the vivid fantasy of a brain with splinters of bone poked through it. Beneath that notion, though, was a very different idea. Another one of those mental mosquitoes was whining around his head, the inside of his head rather than the outside. He was thinking, how does a cloud know what a coat rack looks like? A notion so absurd it sounded like the caption to a New Yorker cartoon. He sucked at the thin, cool air, and for the first time wondered what the temperature would be like in 6 hours, when the sun went down. But by then, he would be on CNN. He would be the biggest news story in the world. There would be a gnat swarm of TV news helicopters whirring around to get live footage of the man who walked on clouds. The GoPro video would be running on every channel in an hour, would be all over the internet. He wished he had not been such a shrill and pathetic panic case in the Cessna. If he'd known he was going to be on a video seen worldwide, he thought he could have at least pretended to have nerve. Aubrey had wandered a few steps from the coat rack, reeling along in an only half-aware way. He paused and looked back. The coat rack was still there. The coat rack meant something. It was more than a coat rack, but in his headachy state, he could not work out its full importance. He walked. At first, he walked like a man who suspected he was on rotten ice. He would slide 1 foot forward to be sure the cloud would remain solid underfoot, kicking puffs of mist ahead of him. The surface held, and after a bit, he began, not even knowing he was doing it, to walk normally. He stayed at least 6 feet from the edge at all times, but initially did not wander toward the bulge in the center of the cloud. Instead, he found himself circumnavigating his desert island in the sky. He scanned for airplanes and paused once when he saw one. A jet drew a line of white smoke across the brilliant blue. It was miles away, and after a moment, he stopped paying attention. He understood he had no more chance of being noticed than if that plane were passing overhead while he walked across the campus of the Cleveland Institute of Music, where he had been an undergrad. He was lightheaded, and he held up now and then to catch his breath. The third time he stopped, he bowed his head, gripped his knees, and inhaled deeply, until the vertiginous about-to-fall-over sensation passed. When he straightened up, he was seized with a sudden, perfectly sensible realization. There wasn't enough air up here. Or, at the very least, there wasn't as much air as he was used to. How high was he? He remembered Axe telling them they were at 12,000 feet right before the Cessna lost power. Could you even breathe at 12,000 feet? Obviously, he was breathing now. A phrase, altitude sickness, rose to the top of his thoughts. He was a long time circling his vast platter of fog. For the most part, it was flat, a bit lumpy here, dipping a bit there. He climbed to the top of the occasional dune, descended into a few shallow ditches. He lost himself for a while in a confused series of gullies on the eastern rim, wandering through narrow crevasses of white fluff. In the north, he paused to admire a mass of cloud boulders that bore a close resemblance to the head of a bulldog. On the western side of the cloud, he crossed a series of 3 swells that looked like enormous speed bumps. But in the end, he walked for almost an hour and was surprised at how featureless his hubcap-shaped island really was. By the time he made his way back to the coat rack, he was dizzy and weak and sick of the cold. He needed something to drink. It hurt to swallow.
In Aubrey's experience, dreams had a habit of making jumpy, improbable leaps. First, you were in an elevator with your sister's best friend. Then you were boning her on the roof in front of family and friends. Then the building began to sway in a violent wind. Then cyclones were touching down all over Cleveland. Here on the cloud, though, there was no narrative at all, let alone a whirl of frantic dream incidents. One moment staggered into the next. He could not dream his way off the cloud and onto something better. He stared at the coat rack, wishing he could send a picture of it to Harriet. Whenever he saw something beautiful or improbable, his first impulse was to take a snap and send it to her in a text. Of course, if she started getting photographs of clouds from her missing presumed dead friend, she would probably think he was texting her from heaven. She would probably start screaming her... And at that moment, Aubrey Griffin remembered it was the 21st century, and there was a smartphone in his pocket. It was in his cargo shorts, under his jumpsuit. He had switched it off when the plane was taxiing down the runway, as one would on any flight, but he still had it. Now that he was thinking about it, he could feel it digging into his thigh. He didn't have to wait for them to download the footage on Axe's GoPro. He could call them directly. If he had a strong enough connection, he could even video chat with them. He snatched at the zipper of his jumpsuit. The cold air knifed into the opening, going right through the t-shirt underneath. Aubrey wrestled the phone out of his pocket, and it flipped right out of his sweaty hand. Aubrey cried out, sure it would drop through the cloud and vanish. It didn't, though. It landed in a cup of hardened fog, shaped almost like a soap dish. He snatched the phone back up, shaking helplessly now from the shock of sudden hope. He squeezed the button to turn it on, his thoughts running ahead to the next bit. He would call Harriet, he would tell her he was alive. She would begin to sob with relief and incredulity. He would start to cry, too. They would both have a happy cry together, and she would say, "Oh, my God, Aubrey, where are you?" And he would say, "Well, babe, you aren't going to believe this, but..." The screen of his phone remained stubbornly black and blank. He pressed the on switch again. When it still didn't light up, he squeezed the on button as hard as he could, clenching his teeth as if he were engaged in some activity that required brute force. Loosening a rusted lug nut on a flat tire, for example. Nothing. "What the actual fuck?" he said, squeezing and squeezing until his hand ached. His dead phone offered no explanations. It didn't make sense. He was sure it still had a full charge, or close to it. He tried a force restart. Nothing. He pressed the glass face to his brow and begged it physically to be good to him, to remember how well he'd treated it over the years. Then he patiently tried again. Nope. He stared at it, his eyes dry and sore, hating Steve Jobs, hating his phone service carrier. "This is not fair," he told the useless brick of black glass in his right hand. "You don't get to just die. Why would you just stop working?" The reply he heard in his mind came not in his own voice, but in the voice of Jumpmaster Axe. "What the hell, man, we just stall out?" And Lenny the pilot's reply, "I don't know, everything just died." A bad thought began to take shape. Aubrey had a Shinola watch, a Christmas gift from his mother, a thing with a leather strap and honest-to-God moving hands. It didn't have apps, didn't connect to his phone, didn't do anything except look good and tell the time. Aubrey pushed back the sleeve of his jumpsuit to stare at it. The hands read 4:23. The second hand wasn't moving. He stared at the watch face without blinking until he was convinced the minute hand wasn't moving either. The cloud had done something to the Cessna when they flew over it. It emitted some kind of electromagnetic force that could zap the battery in a light aircraft, or a watch, or a smartphone, or a GoPro camera. The idea was so woeful he wanted to shout in dismay. The only thing that stopped him was fatigue. Shouting up here in the cool, dry air seemed like a lot more effort than he could manage. He saw clearly now. No one was going to upload a video of him lost on an island of cloud, a Robinson Crusoe of the sky. He was not going to go viral. News helicopters were not going to crowd around the man who walked in the heavens. If they got close, their cameras would record nothing, and the helicopters would drop like cement blocks. But no one was going to come because his Jumpmaster's helmet cam had fried along with the battery under the plane's hood. The video might have recorded a few unpleasant minutes of Aubrey growing nauseated with anxiety, but it had certainly lost power well before they took the plunge. The unfairness of it toppled him. He dropped heavily onto his rear, arms crossed over his knees. But even just sitting up required too much effort. He curled on his side, going fetal. Clouds puffed and settled around him. He decided to shut his eyes.